Chairman Duncan Hall, I think we are ready to begin when you are.
Okay, excellent. Let us begin then. Welcome everyone to the Program Review Committee of the Housing Authority, our first meeting for the new year 2021. And as I mentioned before, everyone looks beautiful, wonderfully alert, must have had all the coffee they need by this time. And I think we're about ready to have the roll call. Sylvia, if you would please.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll go ahead and do a roll call here real quick. Chairman Duncan Hall?
Present.
Commissioner Carrington?
Present.
Commissioner Apostolo? Commissioner Apostolo, I think you're on mute currently, but I see you. Okay. Commissioner Ritchie and Commissioner Bailey. We do have a quorum, and it is 10:33 a.m. Sorry.
Okay. I think our first order of business is the approval of the minutes from our last meeting, which was June 18th, I believe, 2020.
Yes.
Is there corrections to the minutes? If not, then I will entertain a motion for approval.
I so move.
All right, Mary moves. No, pardon me. Edwina moves. And Mary is sitting. Okay. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Okay, the minutes are approved. And I think at this point, I'm going to turn the meeting over to Leilani, who I understand has a presentation. And will you kindly introduce Leilani, our very distinguished guest today, in addition to Suki, who we all know and love?
Yes, thank you so much, Commissioner. Good morning, everyone, colleagues, and distinguished guests. My name is Leilani Limbiegas, and I serve as the Senior Director of Community Development for the Housing Authority of the City of Boston. And today we have our very valued partners and friends from communities and schools. As most of you already know, they are our largest contract with HACA, and they're a very vital component of our youth educational success pillar. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Suki Steinhauser and Cami Warren from Communities and Schools. I'll be sharing my screen, so just let me know when you're ready to transition. So hopefully I do this right.
Thank you so much. This is Suki speaking, and I'm the CEO of Communities and Schools of Central Texas, and I know many of you, and some of you I've known for many years, and it's just always a sheer delight to be able to come and talk to you. We were doing mic checks earlier, mic check, and I thought, I'm sure Mr. Gerber is going to be here. But then I saw him come on. So I think we're good. We've got our mics. All of our mics are checked. I want to give you a brief update on where we've been. I only have 10 minutes on the agenda, and I know Dr. Duncan Hall is going to ask at least 15 minutes worth of questions. So I'm going to just launch right into giving you my update. And if I'm looking off to the side, it's because my bifocals are really not up to this task, and I have to look at a bigger screen. So just mind the slides, and you'll be good. Okay, so CIS, I think many of you know that our focus is really surrounding students with a community of support, providing them resources and all types of different support so that they are empowered to both stay in school and achieve in life. And the vast majority of our work in CIS is within the school walls, but we are certainly we have a long, wonderful experience working in public housing, which is a major exception to our in-school kind of approach, and particularly when the schools have been closed or open and closed and open and closed, we have been working remotely quite a bit. So you can go to the next slide. Okay, so our approach with SmartKids, which is the name of our program that operates in public housing, Smart Kids is we have three main pillars. We do lots and lots of supporting students in every kind of way. We take a very holistic approach to working with students. So all of these things, academic, social, emotional, et cetera, all of those things we are supporting kids on. But we also work with parents, and this in our family supports, that's been, you know, just really important in this last 8 months. We are very holistic in terms of meeting the needs that the family presents, and working with other organizations to do that as well. Particularly during the COVID pandemic, we have been even more, if you can imagine it, even more involved with families. And then the third pillar is to engage with the community, both within the properties we serve and without, bringing resources onto campus, onto the property, to make sure that folks have what they need. And then if you go to the next slide, it's just a transition slide. I want to share with you our program outcomes very briefly from last year. So this is from the last academic year. Next slide. You can see that last year, of the students, the students who live in the Housing Authority properties and are within our case management program, 75% of them improved their class grades by at least 5%, 74%, so about three-quarters on all of these measures, three-quarters of the kids engaged with CIS on behavior improved, and 74% improved their attendance rate. For people who have a long memory, you'll know that this is a little bit lower than prior years, and that is because we had to stop the measurements in March when schools closed, because there was all of the systems for measuring these things were no longer valid. Therefore, we lost out on 2 months of measurable outcomes. So this is, even by mid-March, the kids had already improved this much. By the end of the year, 99% of our kids were promoted and 100% of our seniors graduated. We'll go to the next slide. I think this might be what you're really interested in, which is our COVID response. And it's a three-part response. It's really like a 1,000-part response, because there's so much coordination needed to help make sure people have what they need for life to be successful. But we focused on basic needs, family support, and academic engagement with our Smart Kids families. Okay, the next slide. So for the period of March through December, we provided over $41,000, nearly $42,000 in direct financial assistance. So if we knew that a family was without food, we would provide a gift card. If we knew that they, you know, the kids had busted out of all their clothes, maybe that's what they needed money for. Some of them needed money for cleaning products or for medical or for baby supplies. Whatever it was, we were able to provide direct assistance. Toward the fall, it's been more in terms of rent and utility assistance, and we are tracking very carefully all of this information, and we're able to analyze it accordingly. We're very happy that we were able to provide 75 students with devices, so laptops or tablets and hotspots. This was, the value of that was $30,000. We budgeted early on, we raised money early on, and we helped lots of kids get what was absolutely the key to staying engaged in school when schools were shut down. These were distributed in the spring semester. And our belief is that these are a gift to the family, because this is a family asset that can help them with both school and taking care of all of the other things that we all are used to using our computers and the internet for. We've helped with transportation, we've helped with masks, and we've done lots and lots of referrals to outside resources that can be more sustaining, like helping them get connected to some other longer-term assistance rather than the short-term assistance that we've been providing, or in addition to, I should say. Okay, next slide. So this is for the fall alone. And you can really see, we served in the fall, we served 281 students with case management, both in person and virtual. And we had 1,200 hours of parent and family engagement. I will tell you, this is a lot. That is a lot of direct service hours. Did a lot of home visits, even more than we typically do in public housing. Our our home visiting and public housing is way more than the rest of our agency. We believe that we want to be very, very closely connected to all of our families, because if we're going to see improvements with kids, that's where it's going to come from. And I know I need to speed up, so I'll just, you can just look at all these other areas and then go to the next slide. I was talking about the increase in family engagement. I don't know if this is triple or more, but in comparison with the prior fall where we did 71 home visits, in the this past fall we did 242 home visits. So what is that? A little more than triple, right? We say home visits, but in fact these are porch visits. We're not going into homes. We are conducting these on outside. And also the number of service hours to families is greatly increased. We're going through a pandemic. We're doing everything we can at CIS to make sure that the whole family is supported, and ultimately the child is then supported. Okay, next slide. So what does family engagement look like? Porch visits, maybe meeting on campus if the parent is maybe dropping off their child and we can catch them, phoning, emailing, working with the parents over Zoom, or the whole family over Zoom, where everybody kind of gets in on the fun and we talk to the parents and the kids are there. And it's been very family oriented. We do want to keep up with our check-ins because we want to ensure support. We want the families to have fun. There is so much stress. So a lot of what we've done has just been really geared at fun and stress relief. We've been delivering resources. In fact, Meals on Wheels snack packs, we've been delivering on site at our on the properties 3 times a week, which really helps with food insecurity. And then, you know, we know what families are going through, and so our staff know the families so well that they really are able to tailor the response to help support the staff, I mean the students. And then we also have created websites and newsletters and just every kind of communication that we can think of to stay engaged with families, help them know what, you know, what the school is needing of them, and you name it. Okay, next slide. I wasn't trying to protect the identity of these people. That was just a blurry Zoom picture. But we've also done some wonderful family engagement virtually. And this was an event that we had in December where it wasn't just Compass to College. We were just talking to high school families. We were talking to families with kids of all ages and saying, let's start talking about it early. What does it take to get to college? And it was beautifully attended, and we had a really great response from the parents because they want to learn, they want their kids to go to college, and we recognize that it's very important to start early. Then the next slide, please. We've had a very tight focus on academics, and as you know, with kids often being having to stay at home, whether it's because the school is closed, because there, you know, there was one case of COVID in their classroom, so they were meant to stay home. We just had to be what I think we always are, but I think we really leaned into it of being persistent and consistent and providing the resources that kids needed. I'm just not going to read all this, but we had to make sure people had the stuff that was needed to learn from home. So in addition to all of those devices, it was headsets, and some kids had no desk or place to sit, and obviously, we always do school supplies, but all of those kinds of things, we had to go find out what was needed and make sure that it was provided. We've also done an enormous amount of tech support for parents. Many of our parents don't have experience using computers. They don't have email addresses, and yet when the school shifted to that, they needed to be part of getting their kids online, signing up for the parent portal, all these kinds of things that I'm sure that I would struggle to do. And so our staff were very closely connected with families, helping them with that. We also, of course, do outreach to teachers, but making sure that we keep a very high standard to make sure that we don't lose track. I just want to give you all props. Thank you so much, Austin Housing Authority, for allowing our staff to meet in person with kids or sibling groups in the community room when schools were closed, when kids were constantly at home, didn't have any opportunity to get out. They just needed a break, and their parents needed a break, and they needed to see other adults who cared about them. So we were able to have meetings in community groups, community rooms, where we did a little bit of homework, we did a little bit of fun, we were able to talk to the kids. they came in sibling groups because already they lived together. And then our staff stayed masked and kind of far away because we had the whole room to ourselves. But it was just so, so wonderful and so heartening to have that contact when people have been very, very, very isolated. We are in the spring leaning in heavily to an incentive program. We have funded an incentive program in the agency to allow our staff to become even more creative and make sure that kids can work towards something that they really want in order to make sure that their attendance stays high and their grades, they're turning in their homework, their grades are good, et cetera. Okay, next slide. I'm trying to go fast. I will just say in a nutshell, we have been doing weekly Zoom sessions for every site. So we can't meet in Smart Kids. We can't meet in person after school, as is normal. So every site is getting at least once a week a Zoom session with their Smart Kids coordinator. These pictures are of one of our coordinators who, you know, she said to the kids, what do you want to do? What should we do? And a kid said, let's build a fort. And so they built blanket forts. And now every time they meet, they start with the blanket fort. And it's just fun and stress relieving for the kids. And then they do, you know, social emotional learning kinds of things, mindfulness, and then just learning activities, learning games, et cetera. We have a partnership with the MAC, the Mexican American Cultural Center, where we started late fall, Tuesdays and Thursdays, having art activities virtually, which is wonderful, super enriching, because even when the kids are in school, they're not getting art and music. They're mostly just in their core classes. So that's fantastic. And then starting this spring, we're going to be having weekly tutoring groups with our wonderful UT partnership with students at UT that we've been partnered with for a long time, but we hadn't been able to figure out how to do it safely until the spring. So that's cool. Next is Compass to College. This next slide you're going to see, we are so incredibly active with helping our students to get to college. I can't possibly read all these things, but we know all of the pieces of what helps be a student to be successful in getting into and attending college. And we are doubled down on that because a lot of young people are very, very discouraged about going to college these days. There, many of our older kids, not necessarily HACA kids, but older students in across the country are becoming very discouraged, and some of them are just leaving high school early to work because their family needs it or because they just don't see the point. And so having very active engagement with our high school kids has been a prime concern for us. Okay, let's jump to the very end, and then I'll be able to take a breath and you'll be able to ask me questions. We are getting very ready to launch into some evaluation work. You can go to the next slide. We have wanted to do deeper evaluation for years. We've done internal evaluations because we have lots of data, and so we can look at our performance. We've done some comparisons with other groups in AISD, and so in order for us to have an even more meaningful evaluation of this program, it's time for us to bring in a third-party evaluator. We've budgeted for this year, and we want to put out an RFP shortly. So we also have a committee form that is discussing how we go about addressing, you know, what are we trying to learn from an evaluation. Further, we feel that we need a professional evaluation or an academic, somebody from UT or Texas State, to help guide us with the knowledge that they have about program evaluation to assess the impact and value of the program, and also to guide us in, you know, what else might we do? What are some aspects of the program that could be improved? We are all about continuous quality improvement. It's not just about effort. Some of it is about being smart, and an evaluation can help us to do that. So I just wanted to let you know that was happening. And when the RFP is ready, we'll send it your way in case you know evaluators that you think might want to, I'm looking at you, Dr. Duncan Hall, people who might want to bid on the evaluation. And just wanted to let you know that was happening. But to sum it up before I stop, just we have doubled down on family engagement. We have doubled down on making sure that kids are engaged academically, and we have been really maximizing our close relationships with everyone who lives or works on Housing Authority properties. If ever there was a time that it was important for us to have those relationships in place, this is the time. This has been the time that we have really realized the benefit of those partnerships and those close relationships. So I'll end.
Well, thank you very much, Suki. Oops, I better get back. All right.
I think I'm going to transition quickly to Barbara. And so we have a very quick, speedy presentation because the contract for CIS is to be renewed. And so this is going to be an item on the agenda for a 12 o'clock meeting. But before we transition to that, I'd like to give Barbara just a few minutes to speak about the other youth educational programs that we offer with the Housing Authority. And so you have a bigger picture of all the different activities, events, and community engagement that we have with our youth. So Barbara, and I'm going to unshare my screen.
Thank you, Leilani. Just so everyone knows, today is Leilani's birthday, so wish her a happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Good morning. Good morning, Commissioner, staff, partners, and guests. I'll give you a quick overview on our youth educational success, or YES, programming. We've seen a great uptick in our YES incentive, which rewards students for AB Honor Roll and perfect attendance. We have had a 45% increase over last year. And that might sound surprising, but this is largely due to our data sharing agreement with AIST. Now we're getting more information and better information versus relying on individual teachers or individual parents and students to turn in their report cards. So we had, on average, last year, about 262 youth that would get the incentive each quarter. And this year, for the first two quarters, our average is 474 youth. And most of that growth, surprisingly, is with middle and high school students. And that's because those students tend not to turn in their report cards. And it's also more difficult for the schools to give us, grades and attendance, because every class is done kind of individually. So they can't really give us the data when we were getting it previously by teacher. So this has really been great because we can include all of these students in recognition and really help encourage them and appreciate their hard work. So that's been exciting. The Boys and Girls Club continues to operate at Chalmers, Meadowbrook, and BTW. They're serving about 25 youth per site, so 75 youth total on average. And that is due to social distancing needs that the numbers are reduced. We did close down the club during winter break because of moving to stage 5 with the pandemic, but they reopened when school reopened and are pretty much open now, even though the schools have encouraged students to stay home. They're operating on after-school hours because they said about 90% of the students attending are still going to school. And that's their option right now when the school says the students that need to be in school can be in school. So they're taking advantage of that with a lot of working parents in that group of 75 families. The Girl Scouts are doing weekly remote groups for girls. They have different group of girls that have been coming in person are participating remotely, and they're enjoying getting to know the girls from other sites. So that's been positive, and they deliver activity kits to the girls as well. Our scholarship outreach has started for the 21-22 scholarship year. We have applications updated for the Austin Pathways HACA Scholarship, and we're working on getting the links posted for all the other housing-related scholarships, the FADA, TexNARO, Southwest NARO. And since we've moved to PBRA, we also have some other scholarships available, the Atlantic Housing Foundation, the NAMI, which I don't even know what that stands for, but I think those are for tax credit properties, and the Texas Affiliation of Affordable Housing Providers Scholarship. So all of those will be posted on our website. We're also planning an online scholarship workshop in coordination with the FSS Program Coordinating Committee, and that will include ACC, Foundations Communities, College Hub, and other college representatives, as well as information about our scholarships. And that will be in February. And that concludes my report.
And I think that concludes the Youth Educational Success Update. Thank you. And I guess I'll hand it over to you, Commissioner Tyra Duckman-Hall.
Hey, thank you very much. Thank you, Barbara, for that report. Now we are ready to have some questions. And we're going to start with the questions directed to Suki and the CIS program. Commissioners, any questions for Suki?
Right. Suki, on this, our communities and school program, is there anything like it around the country? And as I look at the metrics, I'm wondering if you all have something that you can benchmark those metrics to on similar programs around the country.
Wow, that's a great question. I do get calls from other CIS programs because there are about 130 CIS affiliates around the country. I do get calls because they've heard that we have this amazing program. I know in San Antonio, my counterpart there serves on their board, their housing authority board, and I can definitely find out from her. You know, I talked to her about comparatives. But I would probably want to talk with our national office and see if there is something comparable, because that would be an interesting comparison group, especially because we've been doing it longer. I would think that we would be outperforming, but I think that would be really interesting. So I'm counting on Cami and Shannon taking notes to make sure that we follow up, like that I follow up on that. Yeah, any other thoughts about that?
Well, I think you partly answered my question in that communities and schools is a national initiative.
Yes.
And there's a national organization that you all are members of and you work through and network with. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's right. I think CIS across the country serves about 1.5 million kids. And we're part of this national network, and it's considered the nation's largest and most effective dropout prevention organization. There's a lot of research in our on our model. And so even though schools are different, communities are different, the model adapts. So every place serves the kids on campus, but this is an innovation for us. I don't know if it's that innovative after 20 years. I think we're continuing to innovate, but this is an innovation for us to be embedded in both the housing authority properties and the schools.
Okay. And one more follow-up question. So each of the local communities and school organizations, this is a question, you all get to design your program or programs based on what you think the needs of the community, the schools, and the housing authorities are?
We are private nonprofits with local boards, so yes. But in order to be, to use the name Communities and Schools and to be an accredited part of the affiliate network, we have to follow the model, and our national office is the accrediting entity that comes in and looks at our processes and our data and, you know, looks inside and out the organization to make sure that we are at a standard of quality with services and business practices that meet that, their very high standards. It's a total quality systems, TQS process. So even though we all serve different communities, we have local control, locally generated innovations and partnerships and, you know, fundraising. We don't get money from the national office either. So all of that we are doing locally, but we are part of this this overall standards process. Is that what you were?
Yes, and while you have standards, you get to design the programs that you all feel are most needed at the local level.
And that's exactly what we do on every single campus. We meet with the principal to build out the plan based on their campus improvement plan. What do they need that we can help go to the community and bring onto campus? So sometimes it's food. Often it's mental health services. Sometimes it's enrichment. So when somebody mentioned the Girl Scouts earlier, I think we have about a dozen Girl Scout programs that we run on campuses. I don't think we're doing it within public housing, but, you know, we decide to do that. because we feel that that's necessary in a community where there are girls that don't have positive friend groups, that need to develop their social skills, that need the enrichment. So that's just an example. We get to decide what it looks like within the overall structure.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Yes, yeah, so that answers my questions.
Thank you. Suki, I feel remiss in not having introduced your colleagues and finding out something about them. So could you help me with that?
Yes. First, I would, you know, you all know Cami because she's been coming, but I'd like for Cami to self-introduce, and then a new member of our team, Shannon Sandrea, who is Cami's supervisor, many, many years of experience with youth. But first, Cami, you want to say hello?
Good morning, everybody. It's good to see your faces. I think I know most people here, but I am Cami Ward. I've been with CIS and the Smart Kids program for about a little over 10 years now. I'm a program director, and I get the privilege of working with you all and Leilani and Barbara all the time, and I love it. And I, yeah, Shannon and Elvira, we have both of them here with
us
today.
Oh, they're so good.
Yeah, and so I'll let them both introduce themselves if that's okay.
Hi, everybody. I'm Shannon Sandrea. I'm a licensed professional counselor, and I have been with CIS just since September. I'm a senior program director, and although I just started with CIS, I've been partnering with them in many ways and many organizations for the last 20 years. I have a big background working in schools and with SAFE and Austin Public Health as well. And I'll pass it to Elvira.
Hi, good morning, everyone. My name is Elvira Gutierrez. I am the Smart Kids Program Manager. I started with CIS Central Texas in September, just like Shannon. But I have been a part of the CIS family. I was working with CIS North Texas for 6 years, and now I'm here, and I'm very happy to be here. So thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you and welcome. And we am sure we'll be seeing more of you in the future as we continue this wonderful relationship we have with CIS. Now, more questions, anyone? Okay. Well, Zuki, you know, I'm going to ask something, obviously. I am very, very curious about how and your assessment of how well you have managed the challenge of the kids being at home through virtual learning, how they have adapted and let's hope successfully adapted to the use of computers, and how you have managed to assist the parents, many of whom I'm sure are computer illiterate, with not being able to do the face-to-face and, you know, the porch visits, et cetera. So how does this happen?
Well, I'm never shy away from answering, even if there's other people who can answer it better. So I'll give you my short answer and then let Cami take it. I have to say that you hit the nail on the head that this is a major, major national issue that I think there are many children who are very much falling behind, particularly in households that don't have, that aren't particularly computer literate, aren't particularly either well equipped or used to using, as well as teachers who haven't been used to teaching. So it is a national issue. I think we've benefited from fast action. I mean, we bought computers early. Computers and hotspots early to get out to kids because the schools weren't getting it done. Eventually, they caught up. Now, we're not giving out a lot. I neglected to say we're giving computers to all of our HACA seniors in the next couple of months so that they have computers that belong to them that they can take to college that they'll have for them. I mean, we have a technological society, and yet we haven't gone there because children should be learning with other humans. So I think, again, the long relationships we've had and doubling down on just being in just close contact with families, but then I want you to just try to visualize social workers becoming tech support. I mean, it's either funny or tragic or amazing, and I think in a lot of cases it was amazing. We had people spend entire days with a family because they had multiple kids in the family and there was no laptop, there was no email before, just doing every single part, uploading shot records you know, figuring out how to do electronic signature or click the signature. I mean, just, it's just, you can, it's hard for me. And I just imagine what we've been working with. So I think that this is true throughout the agency, thousands and thousands of kids, but it's particularly an issue in public housing where they are under-resourced often. But Kimmy, do you want to speak to the tech support kind of aspect?
Yeah, well, as always, Suki gave a wonderful overview. She touched on most of the things. but I'll just, you know, some of the specific strategies, it was really challenging. As you all know, we talked to you about that last spring, especially when we kind of were just thrown into this pandemic world, right? And so what we and our staff on our team did a lot of was falling back on text and phone call communication. If students were able to log into their Blend classrooms with teachers, our staff would log in as well and have conversations with them through that. They did kind of anything they could imagine that spring. And then once we were able to get devices in the students' hands, that really helped. So once we were able to do post visits starting the very beginning of June, our team was constantly out there. I was as well, just kind of out doing walks around the properties, which of course we loved. We were really wanting to get back out there. And so we were out there every day, and we just went and did porch visits. We handed out masks so that we could all be masked and would oftentimes just sit there on the stoop, right, and walk through how to log into something. If they hadn't been able to log in for 2 months, that's what we were doing right then. Able to really kind of walk them through the process, whether it was uploading documents that they needed to register for class in August, or if it was, you know, talking to a teacher, anything along those lines. And so that was a huge game changer for us, being able to get back out there onto property. And then coming back into August and September, like Suki mentioned, most of our Smart Kids coordinators and our program managers who are on our HACA contracted campuses just kind of set up shop on our public housing sites and would be out there all day or for chunks of time during the day, Monday through Friday, and they would set up a table outside the community rooms and sometimes also have sibling groups come into the community room, and we had plexiglass set up, we had HEPA filters, we had the whole nine yards, and so our students were able to come in there and actually log into all of their classes one day. You know, we have a sibling group that we're very fond of. We've been working with them for a long time at Santa Rita, and there are several siblings who are school age. I think we have like 8 or 9 right now. And so the family, the parents were experiencing a lot of health issues. So we were able to pull in students 2 to 3 times a week into the community room. And our Smart Kids coordinator would just sit there with them and make sure that they were logging into classes, getting their homework done, things like that. And so really trying on both ends with the students and the parents to ensure, A, they had all of the resources they needed, and then just spending truly hours upon hours, either on the phone, in person, online, with the families, making sure everything was fine. So that was like such a huge chunk of our work, honestly, March all the way through probably September.
Can I interject for 1 second? Just out of respect for everyone's time, we do have 2 other presentations. So I just wanted to make sure that we're still on the mark because we have our board meeting at noon. So I don't know if you wanted to proceed, Commissioner Hall, and then we can always take questions afterwards because we'll be speaking about this again during the board meeting.
Okay. I will try to refrain from asking more questions at this point. And then I guess we should go ahead to the next presentation since we are looking at time. But I just really want to say to the CIS representatives that we have that we really appreciate what you have been doing. It has got to be difficult. I still cannot visualize how we can keep our kids up to speed with the virtual learning and the parents. And I just hope someday that we can intensify these efforts because probably if I were to ask you on a scale of 1 to 10, how successful you think you have been, you probably would say there's a great deal of room for improvement. And this is what we need to be working on. And with COVID still being so rampant, it's very difficult, and it will be again for this next semester. So I want to thank you for your efforts, and we'll try to plan together, maybe with the evaluation tool you're using, how we can do even better as we move forward. So thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Leilani, you want to move to the next one?
Madam Chair, I believe it's Pilar Concha.
I think it's Pilar, and you'll be speaking about rent, right? Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Take it away, Pilar.
Yeah, Andrea, will you let me share my screen?
Sure, and Pilar, if you don't mind, maybe I'll set the context here, if, Commissioner, if that would be okay.
Sure.
So as you all know, back in the summer, there's been a need identified in this community to provide assistance to Austin residents who are not able to pay their rent because of the impacts of COVID. As you all know, right over the period just a few weeks before Memorial Day, running through Memorial Day, the city provided HACA, asked HACA to take on responsibility for distributing well over $1 million in emergency relief from funds that they had pieced together. This program then, that program was intensive, required a lot of work by our staff, and had lots of challenges attendant with it. We were asked then to continue our great work and to launch what became the Rent 2.0 program. The program was named Rent. It's a relief for the emergency needs of tenants, or rent, relief for the emergency needs of tenants. And so the program that HACA exclusively ran was called Rent 1.0. And then most recently, we've completed a program called Rent 2.0, which was an additional $12.9 million in funding. And in order to distribute that level of funding, we needed to bring in partners. And so we did. And we brought in CVR, and you all know CVR through their work with HACA on strategic planning and relocation, and through other projects and issues that we've worked through with Melanie Villalobos Campbell, who is known to so many of us from her time both at HUD in the Obama administration with Secretary Castro, but also as a former senior team member at the San Antonio Housing Authority, who we worked very closely with over many years. And so we worked on the Rent 2.0 program, and now we are actually looking at another tranche of funds and to help those who we could not fully assist in Rent 2.0 with, who still remain on the list, with what we're affectionately calling Rent 2.5. And so Pilar is going to walk through what's been really a substantial amount of money running through our books, helping an awful lot of people in our community, and we want to make sure you understand the work that we've done over the last several months, many months, to assist people in our city, and that it is clear that we're going to be continuing that work with additional money that's coming from the city and potentially from other sources as well. So this is just an overview for you, again, of the programs that we've operated and give you a little sense of where we might be headed. So, Pilar?
Thanks, Mike.
And I'm glad to see that Melanie has joined us as well, and she'll offer color commentary.
Yeah, feel free to fill in.
Thank you, Bob. Melanie.
So, Mike covered most of this. You know, why were we asked to do this? The funds were provided to the city, not to the housing authority, and the city asked us because of our experience running rental assistance programs, the infrastructure that we had in place, like forms and trained staff, and for their first round, a wait list technology system. Because there are a lot of people out there that were experiencing a great loss of income due to the pandemic, and HACA stepped up. Mike, I don't think Mike think twice. He said, that's what we do, and we work together when people need us. And so we said, yes, we would assist them. We did this twice, and each time almost 10,000 families applied. And so we know that the need is great here in Austin. I will say that it seems that it's not as great as it is in other cities. There's some things that Austin's doing right because we experience a little bit less need based on our population than others, or at least the number of people that applied was less than we expected. But it was still 10,000 families each time. So the need is still great. And the reason that we did this is because while there still is a moratorium on evictions, landlords are not allowed to evict due to non-payment of rent at this time, the renters are still responsible for making that payment when the moratorium ends. So what we're seeing is people that are not paying the rent have these months and months of rent due stacking up, and they're going to be in a really dire situation when the moratorium ends. And so what we want to do is make sure that we help people avoid eviction, avoid homelessness, because what will happen is people will become homeless or they'll double up in homes, and that will only become another super spreader. And of course, we don't want families in those situations anyway. We did see that the need was at the lower income levels as well. Over 70% of the renters that applied had incomes at or below 30% of the area median income. And so for all these reasons, we were very happy to participate, and we were very successful. And because of that, several families are now staying in their homes where they can be safe. So if you're interested in the eligibility, we did limit it at 80% of the median income, and it was limited to families within the city limits. And they had to be in a rental assistance, in a rental relationship with someone. They had to have some sort of lease, and they had to have their income impacted by COVID and show us how that happened, how they were related. We started to randomly select at the beginning in September about 500 applicants out of the pool of applicants every week, and then we lowered that number based on how many applicants we had in the pool that we were processing. And when I say we, this second time around, it was done by CVR and Associates, who Melanie works with and represents, and so they were doing the bulk of the work the second time around. It did take over 50 staff of HACA to run the first one that we did for 1 month, and we knew we couldn't sustain that and keep up with our own work, so Mike found CVR to be more than able to do this, and so they processed the program, and about three FTEs helped from HACA to administer the project. The difference between the first and the second round, Lisa ran the first round in May, and we were able to learn a lot from that, so we made a few changes with the second round. And in the second round, we made full payments, monthly payment to the landlord. Instead of having to do calculations for each family as to how much the family made and deduct that from the benefit, so the family would pay 30% of their income towards the rent, and we would pay the remainder, and we would cap it at a certain amount based on family. So that called for a lot of calculations. So we removed that the second time around and streamlined it, and we made the full rent payment to the landlord. The payments are made directly to the landlord on behalf of the tenant. Halfway through, the thing that we changed as well was that we, instead of providing 1 month of rent of assistance in round one, in round 2.0, we provided up to 6 months of assistance. And if somebody had rent that was due between March and December, we provided up to 6 months. So we were very successful. We were given a really tight timeline. From September through December 30th, we had to issue $12.9 million. And Lisa and Laura Bodai had $1.27 million to give out in 1 month. So it was quite the sprint, but we did assist altogether between both programs over 6,000 families, with over $14 million in just 5 months. That includes over 13,000 individuals that live in those families that are now safer at home and closer to avoiding eviction.
Pilar?
Yes, ma'am.
Question. So we didn't go outside to the, we didn't go to the ETJ. We only were looking within the city limits of Austin.
That's correct, and that was imposed by the city. Several times we asked to extend it, and each time they were not able to do that. So hopefully we can do some things differently coming into the next round. Right. So there was a large number of applicants that were rejected because they lived in the EPJ and not within the purpose jurisdiction. It was 5,000.
Sorry, one more question. Do we know how many of those 6,000 families, if any, were in our Austin Affordable Housing Corporation properties?
We should know that. We kept the list, and we shared the list with Ron Kowal and Suzanne Shortner so that they can keep track of that, so we can definitely get you that information.
Okay. I was just curious. I figured we did, but thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were happy to help. The great thing about this program is that it not only assists low-income renters, but it's assisting the owners as well. They're getting their rent that they need desperately to be able to run the property.
Right.
So the payments included over 13,000 monthly payments. It was about an average of 2.6 months per family that we paid on behalf of the renters, with an average rent amount of $1,150 per month. It included groups, vulnerable groups, over 1,300 people with disabilities, 281 veterans, and of the Rent 2.0 applicants, over 70% were Hispanic, where, as we know here in Austin, the Hispanic community was much more impacted than other communities by the pandemic. So what are the next steps? The city of Austin found more money and has approved $2.6 million to provide another set of families from the applications that we received between August and December 8th. There were about 2,000 families still left on that list that still had not been processed. And so with this $2.6 million, we think we can assist another 1,000. We'll probably process all 2,000 and end up assisting 1,000 based on eligibility and those that don't complete the process. So we're really happy to continue that they've extended the program. We call it Rent 2.5. And then, of course, you all know that the federal government has allocated money for emergency rental assistance, and they'll be distributing that to cities in February. The city is expecting about $28 million to come into the city of Boston, and they're now trying to determine how much of that will be emergency rental assistance, and they've asked us to continue to administer it. So it's a much bigger number. Not all $28 million will be emergency rental assistance. They are going to set aside some of those funds for eviction prevention initiatives through Legal Aid, Austin Tenants Council, and things like organizations like that. But a good chunk is going to come to the Housing Authority to continue the rental assistance program. There will be some significant differences. The federal government has provided a lot more guidelines this time around than they did the first time around. For example, we will have to pay the provider The landlord has to apply in Rent 3.0. Before, the renter was the applicant. And so the landlord will be applying. That's a big difference. And we will continue to pay the provider, but we will also be able to pay, assist the renter with utility bills that are unpaid due to the pandemic. So we'll be working with utility companies, to make those payments. And that's probably the biggest difference. And that's my report. I don't know if, yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Duplication. So we've run 1.0 and 2.0, what, 2.5? So with this new amount of money that's coming, and if I understood you, both of the earlier programs, we could pay for a period of time for like up to 6 months, I think I heard you say. On the new funds that are coming, Pilar, are some of those tenants, landlords, going to be eligible for this funding if they've already been assisted? So how are we, and how is Melanie and her group, I mean, how are we tracking that? Well, do we need to track it, number one? And then what happens if there's some duplication?
Sure, that's a really good question. This is something that the federal government is emphasizing, is that we do have to avoid duplication of benefits. And so one way that we do that is we use the EIB HUD system to pull families that were receiving HUD rental assistance, and they were not eligible in 2.0. So that way they weren't receiving assistance through HACA and then again through the rent program. The families that were assisted in rent 1.0, they were eligible for rent 2.0, but they were eligible for different months. So because we had the records of what months we assisted them with, then we knew that we were not going to assist them with the same month. So yes, they will continue to be eligible, and because we have the records, we'll make sure that we're not assisting them for the same month again. So I don't know if Melanie and Mike, we wanted to add. Oh yes, Mary, go ahead.
Yes, is this the assistance, the money that we've received, is this for all the HACA properties also? Or is there a criteria that
Yeah, that's a really good question.
Go ahead.
And rent 1.0 and rent 2.0 are families that are our residents and clients were not eligible. And the reason for that was because our programs, our public housing, PBRA, Section 8 programs, already have a safety net in place. When one of our residents' income decreases, then we can decrease their rent as well. What is going to be very different for rent 3.0 is that those families will be eligible, and they will be eligible only for the tenant's rent portion. You know, our tenants pay 30% of their income towards rent, and then HACA covers the rest, or the federal government covers the rest. So for the tenant's portion, they will be eligible this time around.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I think we've earned a lot of goodwill, and it's really brought us a lot closer to the city in running such an important program at a very difficult time. And I think that we definitely did the right thing in administering this. It was very hard, definitely the first time around when we used our own staff and they had to pull double duty, do their regular work and this. But we found the solution. We found the perfect partner in CVR and Associates, who have done magnificent work. They've been available to us 24/7. I feel very sorry for them because we constantly contact them for information, and we're always troubleshooting policies and working together. But Kelly Crawford, too, has been a big part of this. She's run the compliance of this. And they were able to catch really good things to make sure that we didn't make big mistakes. So thank you all.
Yeah, and I would just add that it's been a great team effort. I mean, I think we complement each other with what our respective teams have brought to the table. And we've learned along the way. You know, CVR had the ability to bring in our proprietary software that we use for Section 8 type things and tweak it for emergency rental assistance. But it was a learning process. We were learning what Austin's needs were and what the challenges of Austin's community was in getting their applications together. And we have tweaked the program all along the way, tried to be as light on our feet as we can. And we're making the mutual commitment that when we get to 3.0, which is going to be here before we know it, we've already made some even more improvements to our technology to help the processing along and also the workflow processes, lean as much as we can on our technology to do as much lifting as we can, because of course the staff is the most expensive part of all of this. We've also made the commitment that all of the staff that worked on 2.0 and are working now on 2.5 will be the same staff that will work with us. I'm talking about CVR staff that work with us on the Rent 3.0, so we're bringing all of their experience to that table. And we're just really thrilled to have this partnership. I'm just really proud of the collective team.
I would just echo that. I think we've had a great division of responsibilities that have really complemented and made this program complemented, where we've complemented each other and made this program really much more robust than perhaps in other parts of the country. We've heard quite a bit from other communities that have really struggled to meet the expectations of their cities and to get dollars out. And the technology and database backstopping and the call centers and other work that CVR has done has been critical. The work that we've done in outreach and serving as an ombudsman and policy development and training and a variety of other fronts have been and just making sure that our nonprofit partners are doing all that they can to assist. It has really been a great complementing of skills and talents and resources. And really, I think it's exactly the kind of thing that HACA, will want to do in the future as we look to Blueprint and other programs and initiatives. But the most important thing to us is getting this program right for, these are our neighbors. This is our community, and it's very personal. So, we're grateful to have a partner that knows this community well. And we sort of hold that torch, if you will. And, we're grateful that the city's put forward another $3.2 million that will help us to, get whatever it is, $2.6 million or whatever it is out to, help, our neighbors in need who are still on the list and who have been on that list for quite some time. And that there's going to be another iteration of this program and potentially even more. In the days to come, because we know that there's a stimulus bill that the $28 million that's there. We may find ourselves potentially in partnership. We've been having conversations we're having conversations with the city, and I think there's an interest in potentially consolidating some other programs into our program, like Travis County, so that we don't have to be limited to just serving people within the full purpose jurisdiction of the city. But if someone's across the street, but they still have an Austin address, then we can serve them too and don't have to turn them away. They're our neighbors too. So, there's a lot of different components of this that are in play. And with each version of it, we get a little better. And so we're excited also about changes at the federal level, not getting into politics, but we're excited about, folks who are very committed to housing, who put a lot of priority in the most recent stimulus bill, helping to shape what we think will be a more generous set of policies that will enable us to maybe serve our public housing residents and others who are our former public housing residents, our RAD residents, those who are getting Section 8. Because if you can't pay your $100 or $200 a month in rent and you're a RAD resident, the impact is the same as if you can't pay your $1,100 a month in rent. You don't have the ability to pay your rent to keep a roof over your head. So we're encouraged by some of the policy discussions and changes that we're seeing potentially in D.C., and we will remain through NARO and through CLAFA and through other organizations that were part of an active part of those discussions. Melanie, is that fair?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's It continues to be a moving target as the federal government and localities do their best to try to get this money on the street put up guide rails with regard to what can and can't be done. And we're gonna continue to monitor all of that and make sure that it's baked into the recommendations we provide to the city. And we're just going to do all we can to continue to deliver. I'll just say, the number of people that were involved in this. So Pilar mentioned that when you all did Rent 1.0, you had about 50 people. When you count the number of individuals that were in each of the relevant team members, there were about 75 people working at some point or other on the program from the various partners. And it was amazing how they all came together. Everybody was pushing in the right direction. And we most importantly, despite concerns early on, because it takes a while to fill that money pipeline, we spent all the money by the deadline of December 30, and we are all just celebrating our collective ability to do that and looking forward to providing more service.
So one thing I do want to just highlight for the board that I think is really important, you know, in oversight is knowing, again, where money comes from and where money goes. So when you look at our audit next year, you will see, you know, money flowing through HACA for these programs and probably a lot more to come. So, you know, we want you to have it's important for you all to know that as part of your financial stewardship and oversight of the agency. We're glad that the terms of, you know, what this looks like is, you know, are being set by the city and HACA together. We think we're serving a more complete array of needs in this community, and we're hearing a lot and being informed by our nonprofit partners all over the city who are, you know, helping people to access these programs. So it's exciting to know, again, that more dollars are to come, more neighbors helped, and the programs will hopefully become even more generous than they already are. Mary, did you have
a question?
Yes, ma'am.
For Pilar, okay, the eligibility for the monies, let's say a family was affected by the COVID, was in a hospital, and the family was at home, they can't pay the rent. Is the criteria call for receipts, for proof that they were unable to pay because they were ill because of the COVID?
Yes, that's a really good point you bring up. That was one of the areas that we found to be very difficult, is that the families were in some pretty challenging situations, and yet they had to come up with a lot of documentation to fulfill their requirements. Yes, it is required mm-hmm. for the family to demonstrate how their income loss was connected to COVID. That could be either that they were laid off, it could be because they were sick and couldn't go to work for several weeks. And so, yes, there was a lot of documentation that was required. And so the city and HACA and CBR were very flexible. And in the end, what we did is we started allowing a lot of self-certifications to come through because it was just hard for applicants to find the documentation that they needed. And so we accepted a lot of self-certifications.
Okay. Well, another follow-up question on that is when you receive these monies, does it come with these stipulations that you have to, that residents are required to come up with documentation? Or is that once you get it, you have to make up these, I mean, you have to come up with these criteria so that you know you're giving the monies to the people that really need it?
Would you like me to take it? Oh, go ahead, Paula.
Oh, yeah, go ahead, Millie.
So what was interesting is that when the money first hit the street, it really didn't come with many rules. It was basically, okay, Here's some money, figure out how to do it. But I will share with you that our recommendation and HACA's recommendation to the city, which was also their thinking as well, is because it was federal money, we needed to treat it very mindfully and make sure that it could withstand an audit review at some later date. So the concern [S2] Okay. [S1] That while it didn't necessarily come with all of those stipulations to any given community, each community decided how exposed they wanted their program to be to rules, regs, audits that might come later. And so we all collectively together with the city decided what the requirements were going to be for that. There's certainly been a call in the industry for more guidance so that folks don't put rules in place that aren't necessarily needed. But right. Those things are all still pending.
But it's fair to say that we used the standards that were largely around the Community Development Block Grant Program, and that's the program that has the least, the lowest standards of compliance. They meet all the general rules of compliance, but those standards are reduced compared to other programs that have, you know, tighter rules and regulations associated with them. So we went as far as we could, but we felt that you know, eventually HUD, where the monies are, you know, flowing from, will eventually come back and get around to an audit, or they'll do it. The Inspector General will come and do reviews. And our sense was, let's at least use a generally accepted standard. As a comparison, you know, when we look at housing, We have different inspection standards as well. In the Section 8 program, mm-hmm. we have the least standards so that we can get the most number of units into the Section 8 program. So it's called housing quality standards, which is far less rigorous than the standards we use, Commissioner Apostolo, at our HACA-RAD properties, which is the universal physical condition standard, which is a much higher protocol. So we didn't want to go as high as that and as tight as that because we'd exclude people. And we went to the one that we felt that we could get the most number of folks through safely but compliant and not end up on the we try to view things through the how do you help the most number of people but also meet the smell test as well and the Austin American Statesman test. we never want to be on the front page of the Statesman, so we try to use that standard as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Mike or Pilar, two questions, and I think you've answered my first one, and that is it sounds like that we still had a waiting list from 2.5. Am I getting that 2.0 or 2.5?
From 2.0. We do have a waiting list.
Yep. Okay, we have a waiting list.
Yes. So the waiting list has how many people, Pilar?
So we had about 520 families that we had pulled from the wait list that we were not able to assist when we ran out of the 12.9 million. And in addition to that, we had another 1,500 who we still had not pulled to process. So overall, about 2,000 families that we didn't finish processing and assist. And so CVR is processing those now. And we think we'll be able to get through all 2,000 and assist 1,000 just because the success rate has been low, either because they're ineligible or they no longer need the assistance or they just don't respond to our request for documentation.
So the interesting thing is that I'm sorry. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Well, it's kind of a follow-up. As we get additional funds, we will continue to work those families and individuals that are on the waiting list. Will they rise to the top?
No.
So they've already been selected, and they will rise to the top. We have already functionally served those 520 that were right at the top. So that the city is going to give us again that 3.2 million, but it's not available until City Council fully approves it on January 28th. So we do have a contract and agreement signed, and we're able to move forward. But those 520 represent, Melanie, was it 1.4 million in we have a draw of 200. We've worked through about 200 plus of the 520. And that represents about 1.4 million that we've already made a request to the city for, and that they know is coming, but has not yet. We can't run it through their system quite yet. But as soon as dollars are available, that money is ready to go. And we're also lining up others in that 520 to be ready to go. And then once we get there, we'll see how many more of the remaining 1,500 that we can serve. When we run out of money, then we unfortunately will run out, and then all of those folks will be hopefully eligible. And we'll move them into the RAD 3.0 program. But that'll be a policy call we'll have to work on with the city to determine how those names get transferred over. Melanie, how bad did I mess that up?
No, that's good. I did get an initial inkling from the city that after 2.5 is expended, they may require anyone left over or who needs additional assistance and qualifies for it to make a separate application to 3.0. Just because it's looking like it will be a significantly different program, different structure. But for the 2.5, we're not reopening the applications. We're working with the families who have put their names in the hat in the August to December timeframe.
Okay. One other question, and then I'll get off this. Of our RAD properties, public housing to RAD, do we, or is this a Ron and Suzanne question, kind of goes back to my question of a little while ago about how many individuals and families in our AAHC portfolio, which of course would include the RAD now, have needed assistance. And is there, would there have been any reason that we had isolated our RAD properties from the other AAHC properties?
So the RAD properties have not been eligible to participate in the program. These programs to date, Rent 3.0 may include those RAD properties, but they have been explicitly excluded by federal guidelines to this point. So our hope is that we'll be able to change the rules. The good news is that you know, in the AHC portfolio and in the HOC and in the HOCA low income housing portfolio, and Sylvia can speak more to this. We're continuing to see very high levels of rent payments. People came up, but there are a number of folks that we are working through rent repayment agreements and other things. If people talk to us, we're not actively evicting, and even if the moratoriums weren't in place, we're not seeking to evict people. We're in the housing business, and if people come to us with problems and are talking to us, and we've had really wonderful resident families that have been talking to us, and that's been immensely helpful. We're still seeing, I think, significantly high rent payments, you know, 90% plus.
Oh yes, much higher than that. We're at close to 97% on rent collection rates, Commissioner Carrington. And to Mr. Gerber's point, for our rent properties, they have the safety net that Pilar mentioned previously. When they do experience some type of a income loss or some other type of situation that does impact their ability to pay rent, they do have the ability to report that change to their property manager, and then we timely adjust their rent to take that income loss into account. So they have that safety net already built in.
I just wanted to mention that we do have that grant that we just got from United Way to help about 100 families with assistance that they could use toward paying their rent if they've been impacted by COVID. So that is a kind of additional layer that we're just implementing now. And when we ran that information, we found about 100 families, about 150 families that were behind on their rent at that time that we did the grant application, which was I think in November.
Yes. That's definitely a wonderful opportunity and resource that will be able to assist a number of those families who have fallen behind on their rent. But it could be for other circumstances, not necessarily because of income loss. And so we will definitely be utilizing those funds to assist as many possible.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioners, are there any other questions for Melanie? I know she's going to pull off the line in just a moment. I would just say again, CVR and Melanie have been tremendous partners. I would also just make note, I know I've talked to each of the commissioners, and I don't see, I think we're pretty safe on this call. I also briefed each commissioner yesterday about the potential of another opportunity, and I would just note that that after careful review with our partners at CVR, we've collectively decided not to proceed with that opportunity. And so I can provide more details, but I would just say that one of the things that I think is important for any organization is to look carefully at your capacity and to make the call and to know, you know, when you see operational issues that are going to present you with the potential of not being successful. And, so I'm glad that we together made that call. And so we look forward to potentially partnering on other work, you know, down the road if we can be, you know, helpful. And we're grateful to have CVR as our contractor for, you know, for rent 2.5 five now, and looking forward to continuing that work through Rent 3.0. So, Melanie, anything else you want to add? But I just think I know I did brief folks a little bit yesterday, and so we'll take that issue off the table, and there won't be an executive session. But I just want to let folks know that I appreciate your attention to it yesterday. But I think we're going to be holding off there. Melanie, anything you want to say?
Not other than I think we all feel mutually the same about our partnership. It's really been a tremendous success. We admire the work that each of you have done. Pilar, you've been an amazing contact with the community-based organizations. Kelly, you're a keen eye on all of the specifics with regard to the residents and their applications and things that need to be reviewed. And Mike, just our collective access to each other, because we've had a lot of late night conversations, a lot of over the weekend conversations, just to keep the work moving and to be able to have that relationship work so productively. We're just all very grateful.
My wife is like, who's this Melanie person? Who I want to
Melanie, I will tell you, and I don't know that I've told Mike this, but my gentleman friend says there is no short conversation with Mike Gerber. I mean, can I bend your ear for about 3 minutes? There's no short conversation with Mike.
I enjoy every minute of it.
But thank you. Well, of course, we do too.
I'm grateful for that. Really. Melanie, thanks a ton. So we'll, if you guys don't mind, we'll switch to our next topic, which is just to give you a quick overview of Rosewood. I don't think there's anything dramatic that we want to share. Mel, thanks again. I don't think there's anything dramatic about Rosewood that we want to share with you. Just want to give you a quick update on the progress we're making there. Sylvia, why don't you, I'll turn it over to you.
Absolutely, and I know that I'm keeping you from a bathroom break before the main meeting, so I'll be as brief as possible. In your binders, you should have seen in one of the inserts this lovely brochure that's titled "Now is the Time for Rosewood." So I do ask that you, at your convenience, please take a look at the brochure. These were printed for all of our residents, and they have received this update brochure, and we're also going to be using it for additional outreach efforts. And I am mindful, and I've already alerted Ken about that weird little rectangle on one of the images, so that is not widespread, and apologies for that little snafu in that brochure. I did also want to point out that the content of the brochure is in Spanish, so there is an insert that includes all of the information in Spanish as well. So I just wanted to let you know that is very important to have that translated. So I did want to give you some additional quick updates. So the pre-application for the tax credit award has been submitted earlier this month, and we have had ongoing contacts and outreach with several elected officials that will be critical to receiving the maximum points for the application. And so we have had very, very positive interaction with Council Member Natasha Harper Madison. And her office is fully on board and very supportive of the redevelopment proposal. And we've also just this week had an opportunity to chat with State Representative Cheryl Cole. And she is also very, very supportive of the project and will be providing a support letter for the application. Also ongoing contacts with the Neighborhood Association, Blackshear Prospect Hill Neighborhood Association, as well as OCEAN, which stands for Organization of Central East Austin Neighborhoods. And so they have also been very positive in their feedback and have expressed support for the project. I think the Blackshear Prospect Hill Neighborhood Association isn't quite sure if they are on record with the county or the state, which is a requirement in order for the support letter to count. So that we're not waiting until the last minute, we do have a backup plan to get that support letter and that QCP quantifiable community participation packet filled out through the resident council at Rosewood. So we do have a plan B there. We have also, and I did have an opportunity to drop off a color copy of the renderings that the board members were able to see in December or November, I believe, over to former council member Aura Houston, who has been very involved and has wanted to remain involved in the ongoing efforts. And so I did have a lovely conversation with her yesterday, and she did share with me that she was very pleased with what she saw on the renderings. So that was wonderful to hear. She did have just a few questions, and again, would like to stay involved. And she said that she will be there with bells on for the groundbreaking. So that's wonderful to hear. We're continuing to gather support letters from our nonprofit partners, such as Communities and Schools and the Boys and Girls Clubs and Austin Area Urban League and Goodwill and others. Barbara Jackson and her team have been taking the lead on that, so thank you to the Pathways team on that. And we've also, just based on some preliminary feedback from our tax credit consultant, Audrey Martin with Purple Martin, looks like, based on the preliminary list of pre-applications, that Rosewood Courts is positioned very, very well to be in the money through the at-risk set-aside. So that, of course, is fantastic news, and we hope that it remains that way. And I know Mike is doing a lot of great work in the background to make sure that we do stay competitive. And the full application for the tax credit program will be submitted by March 1st. So we're in really great shape. Again, our tax credit consultants, our developer partners, our architect teams are in full gear. And on, you know, we've got the gas pedal on high. So we are very, very optimistic that this truly is the time for Rosewood. So thank you all for your ongoing support, commissioners, and, you know, look forward to providing you more frequent updates as we get to that March timeline. Any questions I can answer for right now?
Sylvia, you may have said this, and I should know, but I don't remember. Whose council district is Rosewood in?
Natasha, Madison. I'm sorry, the city council district? Or
yes. City yes. Council District.
Yes, it's Natasha Harper Madison.
And then Cheryl Cole for State Rep District.
Correct.
Interestingly, Council Member Harper Madison lived at Rosewood as a child.
She did, yes.
And so she was very familiar and fluent in the issues of the property, and her staff member couldn't have been more enthusiastic. The council members have been more enthusiastic. So we're really, really pleased and gratified by that support. And we had a great conversation with council, with Representative Cole yesterday. We had heard of her support from her staff. You know, and Cheryl said, you know, I love HACA, and, you know, and I'm going to be there. So, you know, there's a long standing relationship with her as well from her days on council. So, you know, she's well known and respected. And interestingly, our Chairman Ritchie and Representative Cole both lived at another Rosewood Courts, another Rosewood in Wichita Falls, Texas. So they know each other from that time. So you know, it's nice to see this Rosewood getting the redevelopment that it needs, and Representative Cole was very enthusiastic. To give you all just a quick sense of the race for tax credits, there are some other deals that are in the area that were, you know, that I guess we could be competing with. Two of them have already dropped off out of the four. The other two are deals that we feel very confident by what we're hearing from City Council and others that Rosewood, you know, just frankly, it's far and away has the stronger community benefit. So. So we feel very, very good about that process. Commissioner Avastola, I think you had a question, and then Well, I would suggest we pause for 5 minutes for a quick break for people to get a sandwich or to get
Mr. Gruber, did you want to show those photos from Chalmers? Wait, Andrea has those queued up as well.
Let's go ahead and hold off on that, and then we'll do that during the main board meeting. We'll give everybody a 5 minute break, and then I will let you know that I think we can be done with the board meeting in about 30 to 45 minutes. Several issues have changed, and so I'll share that with you when we open up the board meeting. But Madam Chair, I would suggest adjourning this meeting. We take a 5 minute break, come back at 12:06, and knock out our half hour, 45 minute meeting, and then everybody can have a much more enjoyable, leisurely afternoon.
Commissioner Episola, did you have a question before adjourning?
Oh, yeah. We get the notification back from City Hall in July, is that it, for Rosewood, if we get the tax credit?
We'll find out hopefully by mid-July when those awards have been made, those decisions from the state through Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs.
But the city decision will be made in February, and so we'll work with the city to make the case in February, and we'll let residents know if there's any need. So really right now is the time we need to be communicating with letters and messages of support, and so we're actively doing that, and members of our team are working with the residents and resident leaders on that. We'll know from the city by the middle of February of their support, have that confirmed. And then in March, final applications get submitted, and we will really know, I think. There's a great shakeout that happens sort of March, April, May, June, beginning of July, and we'll be able to watch that action, but we feel very confident on where we are at this point and very encouraged by what we're seeing. So I think there's an extremely high likelihood based on, again, the merits of the project, its proximity to high opportunity areas in our central business district, the type of project we're proposing, the fact that it's in an at risk set aside, all of those things are really working in our favor, and just the other community projects that are competing against us, they just aren't important. Not taking them anything away from them, but they're not providing the same level of community benefit. And they don't rise as high in the scoring because of lack of that community benefit and services as our development does. So it's really great news for us. We'll expect to after we get done with Chalmers West, we expect to move forward onto Chalmers onto Rosewood, which will be wonderful and long overdue. Now really is the time for Rosewood.
Absolutely. And right. Commissioner Pistola, to your question, we are working very closely. Tiffany Middleton and Ruby Roa, we're all working very closely with ADESA Communications.
Commissioners, it's 12:15. I would suggest that we go ahead and get started with this board meeting of the Housing Authority of the City of Austin. I can ask you to turn back on your cameras and just make sure that we've got good connectivity with you. We'd like to go ahead and get started.
Carl, can we do a quick mic check?
Hey, how you doing?
Afternoon. We can hear you loud and clear.
Mr. Ritchie, I think we've got a full house. I think we're ready to start.
All right. Well, Mr. Gerber, will you call the roll?
Yes, sir. Commissioner Bailey?
Here.
Commissioner Carrington? Commissioner Duncan Hall? You can give us a thumbs up and that'll work too. Commissioner Duncan Hall, can you hear us?
Yes, present.
Great. And Commissioner Apostolo? Commissioner Apostolo? Great. And Chairman Ritchie?
Present.
Great. Mr. Chairman, there's a full quorum here, and the meeting can be convened at 12:17.
All right, so we're officially called to order at 12:17. So, Mike, why don't you do this and give us a run-through of what's on the agenda, because I know you pulled some items and whether we need to go to the South Congress PFC board meeting or whether we need to open it up as well.
Yes, sir. So we are going to do items 1, 2, 3, and 4. And 6. We're going to go ahead and take off item 5, and we'll hold that till next month. And then all of the items on the South Congress PFC will be held off till next month as well.
Okay.
We will still need to have a very brief executive session at the end of this, but beyond that, I think we can move pretty quickly through these items.
Okay. Citizens communication. Do we have anybody on the line from the general public who would like to address the board at this time?
Thank you, Chairman Ritchie. Members, I'm Zenobia Joseph. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make a few comments. I've said this before, and it's a positive comment, that I do appreciate the simplicity at which you permit the public to participate in the meetings with the number on the agenda at the top, and I will continue to advocate to have this as a model for the state and try to find a representative to sponsor House Bill 2840 cleanup legislation for the public testimony. As it relates to your housing in general, I just wanted to say in your last board meeting, December 17, 2020, Ms. Suzanne Schwartner actually mentioned the update for Elysium Grand, and I was not familiar with that property, so I did look it up. It's the property that's off of Loop 1 and Palmer Lane. And specifically, what came to my attention was the lack of transit. However, in the board packet, it did specify transit for that location. I just want to call to your attention that a bus stop that is reliant on a flyer only runs twice a day, in the morning and twice in the afternoon. And so Elysium does not have transportation all day. It's not a fixed route. It's just 142 flyer. It leaves the north area, and it goes downtown twice during the peak, and then twice in the evening it comes back. And so I would just caution you and ask respectfully that when you are looking at properties that are north of U.S. 183, that you specifically ask what type of route it is, if it's a fixed route and what the hours are, or if it's a flyer. Because what will happen at these properties that are north of U.S. 183, especially on Palmer Lane, is that the individuals who are low income that live there will be walking for miles. And so I just caution you that there is no transportation in that area. I did send an email in the form of a complaint to a lady named Elizabeth Henderson, who's over at the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs. I just want you to know that this is not unique to the Housing Authority of the City of Austin, but the same problem also occurred with the property by the City of Austin. They relied on Flyer 142 for a property that's on Rutland. And what I want you to know is that the Route 240, which would have served that HEB at Loop 1, which is stated for Elysium, was eliminated June 3rd, 2018, when Capital Metro changed 52 routes. And so while that was a route that was there, it does not exist anymore. And so that is why I continue to advocate. The other reason is because the individuals who have disabilities and rely on Metro access, they are denied access to these properties, because if there's not a fixed route within 3/4 of a mile as the crow flies from the property, then there's no Metro access. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention. And at the local level, if you could amend perhaps the questionnaire that goes to the applicants so that they could be specific, that would be helpful. But if not, I'll try to send something to HUD, because there is no communication back to the person who files a complaint with the state. And if you have any questions, I'll gladly answer them at this time. Thank you.
So, Ms. Joseph, let me just say thank you for bringing this to our attention. What I would ask our staff to do, Ron and Suzanne, in the future, if you would have a conversation with Cap Metro, because Cap Metro, like other organizations, they do make changes, and we may not necessarily be privy to them. I think she brings up a good point about the flyer. I didn't really know the difference, but to be honest with you, I haven't ridden the public transportation in Austin since I've been here. So I'm not sure that I didn't, until she said it, I didn't know the difference between a flyer and a fixed route. But it does make sense if somebody is thinking they're going to move into that development because there's going to be public transportation and there's not a regular schedule for that, then, you know, they would be somewhat deceived or have a misperception about it. And we shouldn't contribute toward that. So I would just ask us to do a little bit more due diligence and have a conversation with Cap Metro about their routes in and around the properties that we acquire in, going forward in the future. Obviously, transportation is one issue, but there are other issues that go into the calculation of whether we go in and acquire certain properties. But to the extent we are looking at transportation, we ought to just dig a little deeper and get a little bit more information for our own edification about that. And again, I appreciate that. I can relate to that because having been raised by a grandmother and we didn't have a car, she actually had to walk a mile to the bus stop where she to catch the bus in order to go to work, and then a couple of blocks to catch it and then walk another mile back. You know, coming back home each evening. So I can relate to folks who lack their own personal transportation and trying to rely on public transportation and having to walk a certain distance. So I appreciate you bringing this to our attention, Ms. Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else with the general public who would like to address the board at this time doing citizens' communication? Hearing none, we will go on to the consent agenda. On the consent agenda is the minutes for the board meeting held on December 17th, a summary of the board minutes. Does any of the board members, any commissioners have any changes or amendments they'd like to make to the proposed amendments before we take action on them? Hearing none and seeing none, the chair will entertain a motion to approve item number one.
I move approval.
I so move.
There's a motion by Commissioner Duncan Hall, seconded by Commissioner Apostolo. Before we take a formal vote, is there anyone from the general public who would like to have a comment at this time? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Mr. Chair?
Aye.
Yes.
I don't mean to be long-winded today, but I did have a comment about the Highland property, if I may. It's item 6 on your consent agenda in the minutes on page 9.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Zenobia Joseph again. I just wanted to point out, Mr. Chairman, I guess it's a technicality in a sense, where it talks about the 80% area median family income. I listened to the December 17, 2020 board meeting, and I do know that Ron, the gentleman who spoke about this item, continued to refer back to 60% area median family income, but I'm also cognizant of the fact that Mr. Gerber actually emphasized the 80% area median family income. So what I want to bring to your attention is the fact that when you rely on 80% area median income, you're actually denying African Americans and Latinos or Hispanics from living in the property for the most part. And I just want to call your attention to a document from June 23rd, 2016. It was actually an article through Austin Monitor, which specified the income levels then. African Americans earn about $54,700. And it mentioned Hispanics are $50,000 at the time, $50,820, and Hispanics earned $43,198. But 80% area median family income as of April 1st was $54,700. Whites at the time actually earned $97,939, and Asians earned $101,699. And the only other thing I'll bring to your attention is that there was a preliminary injunction or injunctive relief that was actually issued to stop the HUD there's a new rule that was going into effect. It was called the Implementation of the Fair Housing Act Disparate Treatment Standard. And so the argument was that
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I would just respectfully say you're asking for a public comment on the agenda item, which was specifically related to if there's a comment related to the minutes, I think it would be appropriate to talk about the minutes and make comments regarding that. I think general comment is closed. On items, we're going very far afield, and I want to be just mindful of this board's time. So I'd ask Ms. Joseph if you could focus really in on the issue at hand, which is the minutes in front of you and what changes or alternatives you'd suggest. This isn't a place for a policy discussion.
I'm looking specifically at the sentence that says, at a minimum, 50% of the units will be leased at 80% of area median family income. The discrepancy is that during the conversation at the last board meeting, December 17, 2020, Mr. Ron, who actually countered the comment that you made, specified that 60% area median family income would be looked at. And so if that is the case, I would ask the board minutes to reflect 60 to 80% area median family income. I would also ask that the minutes reflect the statement that you made, Mr. Gerber, that specified that Redleaf, the developer, did not want to lower the area median family income, and that is discriminatory. That is my specific comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Mr. Chair, staff would ask.
If I recall correctly on this particular item, I remember Commissioner Duncan Hall having a lot of concerns about the 80%. So I think the concerns that you have, while they may not be reduced in writing because these are just a summary, but they were definitely articulated by Commissioner Duncan Hall. And if I'm mistaken, Commissioner Duncan Hall, you feel free to correct me, but I think you made that point very clearly with Mr. Gerber and with Mr. Colwall and Ms. Wartner.
That is correct.
All right. So, again, Ms. Joseph, your concern was addressed. It's just, again, this is just a summary, not a verbatim of everything that's said in our board meetings. But I appreciate you bringing this to our attention. And with that, all in favor of approving the minutes?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries, and we'll go to item number two, which is a update on HACA's actions related to the coronavirus resident support and client support centers.
Mr. Chair, I think we want to highlight a couple of items for you. I would just note that as the year has started, HACA staff is working hard to continue to manage the properties, keep our management offices open, and to continue to provide service for our families. Maintenance staff continue to be hard at work at the properties, doing yeoman's work, as does our Austin Pathways team as they continue to provide supportive services. I'll let Pilar and Lilani and Catherine touch on things that they're working on in just a second. I would note that, you know, one of the things we've been struggling with is, of course, the dramatic increases in the COVID transmission rates in our city, and that has impacted our staff and as people have had different exposures. Last week, for the first time since October, since we opened up our front office, we had to close it for part of the week. So we're now working through different contingencies to make sure that we don't have to close our office again, front office again. That's really important as a gateway to our office and services, having our front desk here at the central office open. But we are continuing to, you know, work from our, you know, work at home, work smart platform, and continuing to have, you know, important connectivity with residents and clients. Laura, would you want to quickly highlight any items in Austin Pathways along with Leilani and Catherine?
Sure. Yeah. So Austin Pathways staff continues to seek and apply for grants to assist our families with issues regarding COVID. And like I reported last month, we've received over $300,000 in grants related to COVID. And then this month we received another $100,000 from the United Way, and $7,500 from Regions Bank and $20,000 from Satva Mattress. And so staff continues to be searching for funds to help our families, and they've been very successful. Thank you, Catherine, Leilani, and Barbara. At our at-home learning program, Catherine's still working on bringing internet to our properties that don't have Google Fiber. Google Fiber did contact us and said that they do have more properties on their list to bring Google Fiber to them, so we're excited about that. We received a grant from to assist the elderly at North Loop with to relieve issues of isolation and to bring digital technology to them so that they can feel connected. So there's a lot going on with North Loop in reference to COVID and helping them there. Leilani continues to work on bringing services to our sites. The Boys and Girls Club and the CIS are still providing services on site. So that's great. We have 14 ACC IT interns that are providing technical support over the phone. They're doing that through the call center and through their own line as well, because they've been around for a while. Residents know to call them. And we also have several devices that have been distributed to parents. I believe it's 86 devices have been distributed to parents of AISD kids. Catherine has secured a great partnership with the Austin Public Library to loan computers and hotspots to our residents. And Catherine's group also conducted a study on how effective some hotspots are based on the vendor. They're not all the same. We found that at Rosewood some hotspots are not working because there isn't cell towers as close by to Rosewood. So Catherine's been very diligent about getting the right hotspots to the residents at the based on the property that they live in. Our support center continues to be open. It has become a vital part of our way of providing services. It's something that we might keep after COVID. It's really helped us organize activities, get information from residents. A lot of outbound calls going out. For example, in December, we used the call center to reach families to register them for the Blue Santa gift giveaways. And to reach our residents that are eligible for the YES incentive for making the honor roll and perfect attendance. So, but residents do continue to call us. We saw a shift in reasons for calling. Residents are calling about safety due to the virus. People, when they're out and about, not everybody's wearing masks and they're concerned about that. And they need assistance with their utility bills. So we're glad that the rent program is going to bring some of that assistance. And that is my report for now.
Leilani or Catherine, is there anything you'd like to
add? Any questions from Ms. Sanchez? Ms. Grego, is there anything you'd like to add?
Well, I see Leilani, you're muted. Hey, can you hear me okay? I just wanted to add a few more updates about the Bringing Health Home Team. We did have administered flu shot clinics at BTW and Gaston Place. And in addition, we have partnered with Elite DNA to provide COVID-19 that is non-intrusive, meaning a saliva testing. And that happened at Rosewood and Salina and North Loop. And we are in the process of bringing that COVID-19 testing administered door-to-door for each unit to all of the other properties. So those are just in addition to the health and wellness updates to Pilar's report. And Catherine, I'll hand it over to you for the Hawker Resident and Client Support Center.
So just reiterating what Pilar shared, good afternoon. And we stayed about the same in terms of our calls in December. They trailed off toward the end of the month. But, you know, one of the best things that we can do is use that center for outbound calls. And just last week, we reached about 200 households to coordinate their COVID testing. And so that ability to have that contactless coordination for something that's so critical
to residents is really incredible. I would also just say we're really deepening our partnerships, the ones that Pilar talked about with AISC, Austin Community College, et cetera, to get some new analytical tools to help us understand how families are doing. And so I'm sure we'll provide about that in next meeting.
Commissioners, are there any questions for staff?
Yeah, it kind of raises a question for me. Not really a question, but just sort of a thought. So when we're talking with residents about getting COVID tested, have we thought about some message to encourage them to go get vaccinated as well, if the opportunity presents itself?
Yes, that is correct, Commissioner. And the reason why we brought the flu vaccine initially is our we have our Dr. Freya Spielberg, who's the lead medical person, the doctor, is the one that actually said make sure that the residents are vaccinated, because studies show that if folks who vaccinate have a less, intensity of COVID if they do end up catching it. So it's another layer of protection. And that is why we went ahead and partnered with Community Care and Right Away Pharmacy to bring those flu vaccines to residents. And we did have an educational outreach to all of our resident council meetings, and also with the officers, and also through the Resident and Client Support Center, and flyering as well, door-to-door contact list, to let them know about the importance of the vaccine. And now we're gearing up to try to secure COVID vaccines to our properties as well. Thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry I missed that part. So let me ask you another question. Is there a way to get our maintenance staff vaccinated first or quickly, so that they are less at risk when you have to go into someone's unit and make repairs?
So we've had a lot of conversations around that issue, and that's included conversations with Community Care, Dell Medical directly, and with Austin Public Health. We actually reached out directly to Stephanie Hayden at Austin Public Health to see how we could advance getting our team on the priority list. We wanted to prioritize maintenance first, property managers and assistant managers and staff that were working here at the front desk. And we've been told that given the lack of vaccines and the struggles with the rollout, it does appear that they're looking at more large-scale congregate sites like the Delco Center and other locations. And that priority at this point can't be assured or assigned to our staff unless they have some other condition that qualifies them. We have been encouraging staff in our calls, and I'll do so again next Wednesday at our regular every two-week call. We are taking the posture that we want every staff member to be vaccinated, and we consider it an issue of workplace safety, not a HIPAA issue, but one of occupational safety. So it's falling under federal labor laws as well. So we're working with our councils in that regard, but we do want to see people vaccinated, and we're actively encouraging everyone who can get vaccinated as soon as they can to be in touch through United Healthcare, which is got where everyone here, many of the team are have received health insurance through United. United is also working to help try to connect people as well. So there's a lot of work going on in that space, but it's been a source of frustration to me and Sylvia both.
May I just make a personal comment?
Sure, go ahead.
I'm in that eligible 1B group, and I'm registered with Austin Public Health. And I try about 6 or 7 times a day to get an appointment for a vaccination, and I can't get one. And it requires a lot of patience, and I'm not there yet.
Edwina, I got in last night. Last night, for some reason, for a little while, they opened it up. Somebody called me and told me about it. And so I worked for about an hour, and I got through it. And I'm going to leave in here at about 3 o'clock, head out to the Delco Center. At the same time, my wife was trying to get through, she did, but it took another hour. And
that gives me hope, Chuck. I mean, I've been trying for days.
No, I had to. I'm on every list there is.
Yeah.
But
sorry, Mr. Chair.
Same thing for our folks. I just got to get on the phone and get on the computers and register, and then just keep at it.
Right.
And I'm like Edwina, I was about to throw the computer out the window, but that's normal for me anyway. And it's just so I'll bundle up with my face mask and my clear plastic deal and head out there at 3 o'clock.
Congratulations, Chuck.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was the congratulations. That was the other thing I was going to say is that to the extent that our employees can utilize their own little networks, like this is, I've learned from friends who have relatives who are in assisted living facilities. They are allowed to be added to the priority list. And so, you know, which is kind of a surprise. But there are ways that people can get to the list. I do know, at least talking to my friends in Houston, what they're telling me is try, even if you're not in the priority, if you're not in the A1 or AB list, go ahead and try to get on, because what they're finding is even those folks that are in that group, they're not having as much, what's the term I'm looking for? Those folks are not signing up at the rate that they would want to, so their space is open. So like in Houston, they're basically saying, we're going to vaccinate anybody who shows up. We got a priority list. If you don't, if the priority folks are not coming, we just want to get people vaccinated to try to create herd immunity as quickly as possible. So I would, some kind of way, I guess you can work with, you know, Michael Bowden and your internal team in terms of, and Gloria in terms of just saying, even if you can't get it through us, find, you know, just think about other ways through your own personal network that you may need to get, you can go get vaccinated. So
one thing I learned in all this, Edwina, I don't know if any of your doctors are at Seton, but if they're part of the Seton thing, Seton's got a list and they're working their way through it. And if you're part of one of their patients, you'll get in quicker.
Well, my, sorry about this, Mike. yeah, my primary care physician, their practice has a list too. So anyway.
Our staff is working on getting our residents on list. Anthony Schmucker, who is the program manager of Ringing Health Home Program, got Lakeside on a list. I'm not sure it was CVS or Walgreens as a senior center to have priority. So Lakeside is on there, and we are encouraging our residents that are clients of community care to reach out to community care and make an appointment, because they are providing seniors and those with chronic diseases that are patients of community care of the shot, so the vaccine. So Anthony is working on helping our residents with that.
All right. Any other comments related to item number 2? Any other questions? Hearing none, this doesn't require any action. It's just an update. So we'll go to item number 3, which is the approval of a contract renewal for communities and schools to provide at-risk services to Hawkins students. This resolution number 2687. There was a presentation on this in the program review committee. So I would ask, I guess, Barbara to go ahead and make brief comments about it.
It's okay. I can do that. I'm not sure if Barbara's still on. I told her I could do it.
Yes, so,
Barbara's still on.
Is she? Okay.
If it's her,
it's Pilar. So go ahead, Pilar.
So Resolution 2687 is requesting approval from the Board of Commissioners to renew our contract with communities and schools at $600,000. It is a sole source contract, and we have received approval from HUD to be a sole source contract. The presentation showed that even though we've had a horrible pandemic, communities and schools has exceeded our expectations. They've spent hundreds and hundreds of hours with our residents, assisting them with technology and learning from home. I would ask for approval of Resolution 2687 for the City of Austin Board of Housing Authority of the City of Austin Board of Commissioners to approve renewal of communities and schools for in-school case management and tutoring services for a contract between January 1st, 21 through December 31st, 21 in the amount of $600,000.
All right. Commissioners, do you have any questions?
No questions, Mr. Chair, but Suki did provide us a really comprehensive report, and I don't think I really realized the scope of what Communities and Schools is doing for us and for our residents under this contract, and I think what they've done has been very, very impressive in light of the pandemic and what's been going on. One thing I did ask Suki, and I would assume at some point we will get this information, but I wondered about a benchmark of how the communities and school participants are doing compared to others around the country. Because what I found out was that there's this national organization for communities and schools. And so they have benchmarks, processes. And so I'm interested how our students are doing compared to what some of the other averages are. But I'm really, really pleased with the work that they're doing for us.
So, I was on the call multitasking, okay, so you couldn't see my face, but I listened to the presentation. I was equally impressed. I liked your question because in the past, the comparison I had been asking was with HACA students who are involved, who enrolled in our program, with non-HACA students. And I think, looking at it from doing a benchmark nationally, obviously there are some variables that they'll have to account for, but I think that's a good idea. I didn't realize that it was, I thought that it was tailored specifically to HACA, but I thought in general these are the services they provide throughout, and apparently I guess it's, they provide a whole host of services, but packaging them and bundling them in the way in which they have, specifically the HACA, is somewhat unique to us, and so I think that's a great thing, and, again, Mike, whether you want to get with Sylvia, Michael Bolden, I'm not sure whether we've done this before, and I may have just missed it, but if not, I think it's something we ought to put together in terms of some sort of presentation to submit for a NARO award or recognition, because it is fairly unique based on listening to Suki and Cammy this morning. But I've always thought it was a good program. I think I first heard about it when Linda Gale White, former Governor Mark White's wife, introduced it in Texas. And I thought it was just Texas unique. And I remember Suki telling me several years ago, no, it's a national program. And she was on their, I think, national board. So in any event, I would say echo your comments. I think this is a great program. Cammy, I would ask you to tell Suki how impressed I personally am with what you all are doing for our residents. Because this has definitely been a very tough time for us as a nation, and specifically for folks who are even more so for folks who are in the low income category. And the services you're providing to those kids, I think helps. It really is a safety net and helps them not fall behind like some other kids are. And so their future, I think, will be a lot different because of what you all are doing. So in many instances, this is you're planting seeds for trees that provide shade for folks in the future. And you'll be able to see that in the future, the things that you are, the seeds that you're planting now with them in the future. So I really appreciate it from the bottom of my heart. Tyra.
Thank you for saying that. I don't want to take too much of your time, but I really appreciate you saying that. And thank you all. I know I've seen you all for years and you've heard me and Suki talk. But I just, especially in the past, 10 months, it is, our honor and privilege truly to continue working with you all and these families, and it means the world to us. So thank you so much for not just continuing to partner with us, but for allowing us on site when not many other people are allowed, and I just really, really appreciate it. So thank you so much.
Okay. Sorry, Commissioner Duncan Hall.
Chair, one of the things that Suki mentioned during her presentation was that they were going to be going out and seeking a third-person evaluator this next academic year. And I would like to make sure that our staff is involved in establishing the evaluation criteria that will be used, since such a large part of their operation is, in fact, the Housing Authority. So I'm not sure how that is going to work out, but I hope that you will keep us posted and that the criteria perhaps can come to us as an information item prior to its being used.
We certainly want to have staff included in those discussions, and we look forward to developing the evaluation instrument. I think a big challenge that we're all facing is that we're, of course, in such a unique time, it's hard to know sort of what the new baseline is. So I know we were intending to do an evaluation this last year and had some funds reserved for that. Is that right, Leilani? But we postponed that because of the pandemic. I would suggest that, we're in just such a moment of educational crisis and job crisis and family crisis that it may be hard to do an evaluation this coming year, but we're going to try to see what we can do. Our biggest fear, and Tammy may want to comment on this, but we've got kids who, I think by the time we're done, are going to lose almost two full years of their education. And I'll go one step further. Thank God for CIS and for our most at-risk kids, because I think that if we didn't have them and the work that Awesome Pathways is doing, I think an awful lot of families would have fallen through the cracks, and those kids would have lost any educational attainment. Whereas I think comparatively, our CIS kids and our hockey kids collectively are probably doing better. By far than the average at some of our schools that we're partnered with. Jamie, anything?
Yeah, I'll take it a step further. I think that, given the comprehensive nature of the program, it's not just the students, but in terms of the parents, the support they're providing to the parents, because I was talking to my optometrist the other day, and while I was getting my eyes examined, she was just telling me how difficult it is that she and her husband both have really good jobs. But it's how difficult it is for one of them to try to stay at home while the other goes to work so that one can supervise the kid while he is supposed to be doing Zoom, doing his lesson plans, and how difficult it is for them. And these are folks who are college educated, have good computer skills, but also just sort of trying to spend that time, make sure that their child is doing what they're doing with schoolwork, and then at the same time trying to work from the house to do their own work, and just that whole stress level. And I can imagine what it would be like for a parent who has very little computer, who's not very computer literate, and trying to get their kid to do work either on a tablet or some sort of computer and keep them engaged as well. So again, I appreciate the comprehensive nature of the program, because you're working with the parents, helping address some of their own personal issues within the house, because it's hard for a kid to learn when there are other distractions going on and other sort of stress levels going on in the house, especially with the parents. So, I appreciate it. And I'm like Mike, thank God for a CSI.
BIS.
Yes, I've been watching too much TV.
I still do that all the time.
They have the ability to binge watch CSI. So it's
No, I just see the commercial. I've watched it once or twice.
One more question, Mr. Chair, for whomever is appropriate.
Go ahead.
Can a student join the Communities in School program anytime throughout the year, or is it something that they have to sign on to at the beginning of the year to participate?
That's a great question. No, we take students all throughout the academic year. Generally speaking, only sort of our administrative positions, such as myself, we work throughout the summer. Our kind of client-facing staff, so our Smart Kids coordinators and program managers that I talk to you all about all the time, they get an extra 3 or 4 weeks off during July. So that would be what I say is the only kind of chunk of time during the year we're not accepting new students because we're not really actively working out there too much. But August, really through May, we're accepting students. And so we have a full case management process that we do with them. And that's kind of the general CIS model. And then as you all have kind of mentioned, we really hone in for the Smart Kids program specifically on the needs for our students and families living in the housing authority. So those services are a little bit different. And so like Suki mentioned earlier, we do a lot more family engagement, very intentional programming on site and with the parents and family members than we do outside of our Smart Kids program in CIS. And, you know, you would ask about the kind of benchmark throughout the country, and although CIS is a national organization, Suki and I, we get phone calls a lot over the years from other CIS affiliates who want to know more about the Smart Kids program because there really hasn't been anything that I've heard in the past, you know, 10 years I've been here, who are doing kind of what we're doing specifically within the Smart Kids program here. So it's really unique and wonderful.
Bye. Thank you,
Cami. Mr. Chairman, can I ask Leilani and Cami, Leilani and Pilar. So when we last year set aside money for additional supportive services over the summer, educational services, what part of those resources went to CIS? And moreover, as we look to this coming summer, have we planned there? Because I think we'll still be digging out of where we are if we get to a large-scale vaccination that we hope that you know our kids will still be, you know, there's lots to dig out from. Can you give a sense of that?
Do you want to take a pillow, or you can take it, and then I'll add it to it. You can start, Pilar.
Yeah, I thought Barbara could add some as well. Go ahead.
So basically for the HACA at-home learning program, at least the majority of the funds was really to establish the classroom that we had in the community. So none of those funds were really funneled to CIS. It's something separate. However, CIS is still providing services in our property on a separate contract. So I will say that through that HACA at-home learning program for the classroom piece, about $100,000 went to a Boys and Girls Club because we started a new classroom, or I want to call it virtual classroom, over at Booker T. Washington. So that was one piece was for that. The second piece was for the paraeducator program that Barbara and Wilma are administering to make sure that we have residents that are certified with paraeducation to provide provide education and assistance to the parents. And that's where we have our two generational model to make sure that the parents are engaged. And the third piece also is, of course, what Catherine is administering, which is the digital inclusion piece, which are the devices. That's a three-legged stool for the money that you approved last summer. Speaking of which, and we talked about this during our last leadership meeting, is due to the fact that COVID will persist longer than this summer, that we might have to propose to request more funding to continue the program. But anyway, Pilar, you can go ahead and add on to that. I don't want to, you know, get further than what we had discussed as a group.
Yeah,
So, Pilar, before you go into it, let me refine my question just a little bit. So, if we think about CIS's role in the summer, you know, and I don't know if CIS has capacity over this summer, but if they were to, because that's not a period when they're typically providing the same extent of services, is there value to us in that? And does CIS have capacity? And is that something we should be looking at?
Go ahead. I just wanted to add that we did have discussions with CIS about adding to the contract for last summer. And that point, it was a question of capacity and being able to implement something different very quickly. They were already changing their whole model on how to serve our families and doing all the additional work that was in there. So at that point, they wanted to make sure whatever they did was, you know, to the high standard that they provide programming. So we did, you know, we accepted that they were going to focus on the things that they were already doing and do it well. But I think for this next summer, it's a great idea because we can, you know, give them plenty of time to develop that, those additional services and provide that additional support. So I think that's a great suggestion.
Cammie, is that something that CIS would be interested in doing and have the capacity, you think, to do well, and would it prevent summer slide and COVID slide?
Very potentially. You know, those of you been around for a while, you'll remember we did, you know, what we called July summer camp within the Smart Kids program many, many years ago. And although we had ended that, I think that was kind of our, for CIS, our first sort of venture into kind of full year programming almost, because we generally do follow the AISD calendar. This last summer, what we did as an agency is we hired a handful of folks to work throughout the summer with those highest needs families. So there were several HACA families and our Smart Kids families who actually received full summer services through this very kind of small specialized team. I bring that up because I think that was sort of our kind of step back into some July programming and client-facing services, which has been a new thing for us. And so I think it's definitely a great time to bring this back up. I'm sure Suki is already thinking about it for the agency, and but I'll bring it back up to her too, specifically for our program and what we could do on site. I think that's a great idea.
So, commissioners, maybe I would suggest that maybe the staff recommendation be tweaked slightly. So we're asking you all to approve $600,000 for the usual rich array of services. We think that the CIS curriculum is the strongest that we have and deals with the most at-risk kids that we have. Boys and Girls Clubs deals with at-risk kids, but not in the same intensive way that we have in through our CIS partnership, because it's so directly connected to AISD, where we identify kids, perform the casework, the outreach to parents, the curriculum that's been proven over and over again. And in the results, and I think that each of the three professionals, Leilani, Barbara, Pilar, would agree that it's our strongest youth education partnership. Unless anyone has major objections from the staff level, I would maybe toss out, sorry, doing this on the fly, that you know we might be interested in CIS building a summer program, but that would require some investment on our part and some a lot of planning on their part. That perhaps the board approve $600,000 today with a contingent approval of maybe $250,000 for to giving staff the ability to then move forward working with CIS to see if we can get across the finish line in building a summer program. And we would come back and report to the board on the development of that program and the additional results from it, but at least we would know that we'd have that item set aside, but come back to the board for kind of a final approval. But that would be focused again on a summer program, all intended on summer slide and COVID slide at risk, highest at risk kids. Is that making anybody on the staff level choke now that I do that on the fly?
I would certainly support that recommendation.
So Ms. Ann Guess, you're our CFO. We got the money in the bank.
Can we
hear you now?
Yes. We can come up with another $250,000 to support this
program.
All right,
I'm
here.
with that, the chair will entertain a motion to amend the current language to add contingent upon development and approval by the board a program, but allocating and setting aside an additional $250,000 for a summer program.
I support that.
Okay, motion by Commissioner Beckenhall.
Seconded
by Commissioner Costello.
I support that too.
Vote. Is there anyone from the general public who would like to comment on this item before the board takes action? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries, and we'll go to let's go to item number six because that's an action item. We can take that up and then come back to item number four.
Item number six is
approval of resolution number 2689, approving the renewal of a contract with janitorial and day porter services to M&R Elite Janitorial Solutions.
Good afternoon, board. Can you guys hear me okay? I'm using my phone and
we can see you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too, and it's really good to see all of you. The board, friends, staff, at least we get to see each other in this format, but I really miss seeing y'all in person, so hopefully real soon we can do that. So Resolution 2689 is a renewal contract for janitorial services and day porter services here in our building. M&R was a new company for us this past year, and they turned out to be a great company. They're very responsive and responsible, and they've been a great partner in assisting us with the additional sanitizing of this building and some of the other properties. So we are happy to ask for your approval to renew their second year contract for $170,000. This includes a 1.5% increase in additional sanitizing services for this second year option. One thing I wanted to mention about this company is that this whole year they've had the same staff providing those services here in our building, which makes it very comforting to me to see the same faces, and we don't have to be constantly training and showing people around. So this just shows how dependable and how stable this company is in providing those services for this building and the Booker T. Thurman Heights and the Henry Flores Learning Center. So we're very happy with them. And if y'all have any questions, I can answer them for you, or if there's any comments.
I got a question. I hadn't heard the phrase porter services since I rode the train back in the 50s. What exactly do they call day porter services?
For this building, we have three staff members. They do all the janitorial services during the day, and that's what we call them, porter services. We changed this format a few years ago just because we have so many restricted areas, and we have so many different kinds of emergencies during the day that it's nice to have them around during the day for when we need something. They're available. So they're just called porter services in that industry.
Hmm. Okay.
Nora?
Yes?
Did M&R keep their price the same? Have they kept their price the same over the past year, because of the additional cleaning requirements related to COVID? How did you all handle that under the existing contract?
Okay, so when they submit a bid, it's a firm bid. And then because we have an option to renew 5 years, we ask them to submit their renewal rates for the additional renewal rates. And their renewal rate was only 1.5. So they get an increase of 1.5 for the second year. And when we expanded the scope to include additional sanitizing during the day, I think it amounted to about $95 a day. And that includes several times a day they're sanitizing, like the elevator doors, the handles, the bathrooms, and any other area that we ask them to. So it's about $95 a day.
But they kept their price the same for 2020 as they had originally proposed.
Yes.
Okay. So they just absorbed the additional cost related to the additional cleaning?
No, no. We pay them the same amount. Their renewal rate is 1.5. We changed the scope, so we did allow them to give us a price on the additional responsibilities or the additional duties that we asked them to. So they did go up $95 a day.
For last year?
For last year, yes, currently.
Okay. Thank you.
Any additional questions? Is there anyone from the general public that would like to comment on this item before the board takes action? Hearing none at this time, the chair asks for a motion to approve resolution number 2689, approving the renewal of a contract with janitorial and day porter services, renewal of a contract for janitorial and day porter services to M&R Elite Janitorial Solutions.
So moved.
Motion by Commissioner Carrington, seconded by Commissioner Apostolo. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none. Motion carries. And now we'll go to an update on the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation's acquisition and development program. And after this item, then we'll adjourn and go into executive session. I just got a message, so I'm going to have to jump off at a hard stop at 1:45. So, Ron, if you could step through this pretty good, you and Suzanne, I appreciate it.
Yeah, Ron, yes, sir, I was just adding, Ron, is there anything that we just hold on next month?
I wanted to apologize to the board for giving them a boring January agenda, and I know they're upset and disappointed that there's no real estate that they have to contemplate in January. But I was just going to quote our previous executive director, who used to say, "Don't let go for a better grip," because things are coming, you know, going to be coming fast and furious around the horizon. So, we've got things coming in the very near future for you, but really nothing of major. Question here. Suzanne could probably do that in about 30 seconds as well.
Go ahead, Suzanne.
Yeah, I was just going to let y'all know we do have a couple of deals that will be closing in 2022, but we want to get our foot in the door with some resolutions next month. And then probably you won't see any more closing on new construction until like March, April.
Okay. Thank
you.
So, Ms. Karen, the board has set the goal of 12,500 units, and if you look at the report that you have in your binders, we're well on our way to 7,500 units. So, you know, we've got a lot of work to do over the next, 4 years, and we're going to continue to be bringing projects and acquisitions and other work to you. So, we'll look forward to, actively engaging this board as we find, the highest quality, highest opportunity housing that we can for the most people that we can. It's a delicate balance of balancing, as you noted earlier in your dialogue with Ms. Joseph, housing, jobs, services, transportation, digital inclusion, healthcare, and so many other things. So we aren't just looking at one thing, but we're looking at a variety of factors and in a market that's very, very tough. And so we'll continue to do that, and you can count on Ron and Suzanne to be quite aggressive in the year to come. But we also are going to be looking for safety and ensuring that we're bringing only the best deals to you that are ones that meet our high standards for excellence and that where the guarantees and protections for this agency are pretty stout. Anything else you guys would add?
I would just say that, our partner Belveron Partners, who you've seen before, has done three transactions, has raised another $288 million, and wants to make Austin a main player in their next fund. One of the deals next month will be one of theirs that they've already identified and would like us to proceed on. So I see them being aggressive on the acquisition side. And from a one other note, if you all are probably all aware, but the 4% tax credit is now fixed at 4%, which is a big deal to us when you're looking at credits. Suzanne spent a lot of time talking to investors and syndicators. I've also reached out to a couple of people. We feel we're going to see about maybe a 3-penny drop in credit pricing, probably in the low 80s, but because of the 4% fix, we think that the equity is going to be much better. The risk or the downside of that is you'll see many developers may not need housing authority at their side because the equity that they're going to be raising will be substantially more than what it has been in the past. We may see some deals being done without the nonprofit participation. Most of our big partners don't feel that way, but I have had that come across my conversations a couple times. So it'll be an interesting year on the 4% credits on the credit list. But anyway, I think overall it's a very positive thing for us moving forward.
Ron, did I hear you say low 80s on credit pricing?
Yes. We're probably going to see somewhere probably in the 83 to 85 cents. But again, remember, it's all competitive, and depending on the need for certain, to get credits out the door, depending on who they are, CRA credits, whatever, that could fluctuate. But I think on average, I think we're going to be probably in the 83 to 85 cent range.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioners, before we jump out of this discussion, we'll clearly over the next couple of months be having lots of discussions about new finance tools and resources. At the beginning of President Obama's administration, which is the closest sort of we have to, a comparable set of near recent circumstances, where we saw a raft of new resources. We're anticipating a raft of new resources and new tools to get the economy, back in play. That will no doubt have implications for Fannie and Freddie, which remain in conservatorship, but, we do financing, with them, in significant ways. Same is true for FHA, the Federal Housing Administration, with the guarantees and other services that they provide. So, there will be big changes in policy, and we will, probably need to do some PRC Program Review Committee work with you, where we bring in some experts to make sure that you've got the most up to date information on what new tools are there and what we're tapping into, so that you're at least aware of them and able to do your due diligence as board members. Before we pull away from Ron's work, just because we're all programs now are falling under. Through Austin Affordable Housing Corporation, all the Austin Pathways properties are, under, the AHC umbrella, although they're managed by Pathways Asset Management, which is the group, of course, that the team at the properties is part of. But this is Chalmers West that you might like to see, just if you haven't had a chance to drive by. This is the view out Mary's window. This is Chalmers East, rather. I'm sorry. And it's looking at that intersection there at Chalmers and 3rd Street, looking to the northeast. Mm-hmm. So this is, you can see the balconies are in. They're working on the sidewalks to the – this is the front of the building where the management offices and the community services will be. So it's a very large space, and it runs really the length of that bottom part of that particular building. If you go to the next slide, you'll see the picture of the naming of the building, kind of looking straight to the north. The next picture shows continued construction, but beautiful buildings coming together, and we're really excited. We're literally a month away from moving in the first residence. Is that right, Ann? Maybe a little over, but not by much. Late February, early March. And then I think there's one more picture. This is, and again, there's about 156 units at this property. These are the two buildings that are being preserved and being converted. And it's really the work internally to convert them to clinic space is is getting ready to start. Right now they're empty, but that work is getting ready to start, and we're excited by you know, how lovely the job got done here on these buildings. Anything you'd add, Sylvia?
No, just very excited, and just seeing the progress happening, you know, on a daily basis, and looking forward to having our residents move in and able to enjoy these beautiful new units and buildings.
So next time you're in the neighborhood, wander by, and hopefully we'll be able to find a way to do some safe tours early and you know, at some point in the spring. So we'll keep you all posted. But it's exciting. This, we haven't missed a beat on this. It's been hard given the pandemic, but yeah, we're really excited that this project has generally stayed on schedule. We may be 6 weeks behind, but generally we're on schedule, and it's and that's impressive. Okay, Mr. Chairman, I think that's all we've got. If you wanted to move to an executive session, that would be wonderful.
All right. So at this time, the board will convene into the board will recess and then convene into executive session pursuant to section 551.071.072.074 of the Texas Government Code to consult with legal counsel regarding legal advice related to pending or contemplated litigation, a settlement offer, discussion about the purchase, exchange, lease, or value of real property, and the discussion of appointment, employment, evaluation, and reassignments. And then 0.087, discussion of certain economic development negotiations. And so with that, we will convene into executive session.
Great. And we don't anticipate any action item coming back. And so thank you to all who are not part of the executive session for pulling off the board meeting. And why don't you stay on? And Ron, why don't you stay on?
Session, this conference will now be recorded.
Okay, we're back in regular session. The purpose for which we met in executive session having been taken care of, we have adjourned and are now back in regular session at whatever time it is, 1:54.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe there are any actions requiring any, or as part of the discussion that required any kind of action in the executive session, and staff has no additional reports to provide to the board. I just wanted to thank the board for all of your support during a difficult holiday season as we worked to serve our residents and clients, and I especially want to just give a big shout out to the, to the executive team who, have demonstrated incredible skill in holding things together in their respective divisions. This is about as hard as it gets. If you come and walk through here on any given day, and I'm here most days and Ron's here most days, you'll see, a couple of people who are working over in finance to keep the checks getting cut. And, Nora or a member of her team keeping procurement moving forward. You'll see folks coming in to, drop stuff off for clients or to, get paperwork or to, exchange, quick exchange of information or to get an update to some technology. But across the board with the, really it's remarkable, that out of the entire organization, with the exception of one person, we were fully able to get everybody integrated into some kind of really productive, work. And even that one person, it was just a technology thing. They just really struggled with the technology piece. So we have them doing other productive things, and that's okay. Because they weren't able to do their regular job, we just transitioned them into other things. So everybody is fully engaged, and I hope you have confidence, in that. But it is really hard. And I know that inevitably when you can't be out among people, and we're an organization built around people, that it's really hard to be missing that piece of it, the one-on-one piece. I mean, Ron sits, 10 feet that way, and not being able to sit in his office and to cover ground, the way we normally would, has been really difficult. But we haven't missed a beat. You know, we just talk on the phone, or we talk by this, or we talk through masks in the hallway, and we just make it work. But I want you all to know that I know you all in your professional lives or in your own personal lives are experiencing challenges, and we're all tired of this. As an agency, we are supportive of again taking the politics out of it, but we have been anticipating the ability to open up potentially as early as some point in March. That's clearly not going to happen. And out of respect for our new president's request that we adopt a stay masked and work from home to the extent we can policy for the next 100 days, our executive team has determined, and unless there's objections from the board, that we'll stay closed for the next 100 days, which takes us roughly to May 1st. And out of respect for that new federal policy, in the hopes that federal leadership and state leadership and local leadership will be more coordinated on vaccines and provide an opportunity for everybody to have access to a vaccine or be well on the way to making progress there and in getting people vaccinated and bringing about some return to normalcy and the ability to work safely. So we're all looking forward to those things, but right now just know that people are working hard, and it's a privilege to work with each of them, and I get to see directly how hard each of them works, which is way harder than me, and just have a lot of respect for what they each bring to the table, and I they won't tell you, but I sure want to let you know. That's all we've got. Sylvia, anything you want to share?
Well, Mike, I think I can speak on behalf of the board members. I think just don't think it hadn't gone unnoticed. I mean, we are well aware. I don't know how many Zoom calls I've had to be with you on in the middle of the night, but we're aware that things are moving in an incredibly unusual time. Any other commissioners, anything else? Okay, there's nothing else to be brought before the commission. I'll entertain a motion to Mike.
Oh, Chuck, I missed two of the quick things. We had two important birthdays. Edwina celebrated a birthday last week, and Tyra celebrated one this week. So I just wanted to acknowledge
Tyra,
those
happy
days.
Birthday.
Happy birthday.
And on that happy note, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So move.
Do I have a second? Well, and I'll second it. And seconded by Tyra Duncan Hall. All in favor say aye. The ayes
aye.
Have it. Are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Take
Thanks
care.
All.
See everybody.